Welcome to New Books in Politics. I'm your host, Jeff Bloodworth. This week, we have an interview with Michael Grunwald. He has what I think is a really fantastic book. It's called The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Grunwald is a reporter for Time magazine, and he has used all his, you know, not only just reportage skills, but his contacts. I mean, this is a book that's based on reams of interviews with White House officials, Joe Biden, Rahm Emanuel. They gave Grunwald some really top-level first-person access. And as a result, what we get is at least one reporter's view of what the stimulus package, if you remember back to 2009, Obama's stimulus package, and what Grunwald claims is that this stimulus package, that $800 billion bill that Obama passed in the first few months of his administration, really amounts to, it tells us what the president's agenda is, and really, according to the author, modernizes the New Deal for the 21st century. And what Grunwald does, I think, is kind of rescues the stimulus package and in at least telling us what the administration believed it was doing with this really extraordinarily large piece of legislation. It's a nice, breezy read. It's, you know, nevertheless, quite, you know, even though it's a page turner, it's a solid piece of reporting. So it's really the best of both worlds. I think we have a pretty interesting conversation with Michael Grunwald, and I hope you enjoy the interview, and it might even encourage you to go out and pick up the book. Welcome to New Books in Politics. Today we have Michael Grunwald. I'm sorry. The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Well, Mike, why don't you tell us, before we start talking about your book, why don't you tell us just a little bit about your, you know, your professional and personal background?
Oh, sure. I've been in the dreaded mainstream media for 20 years. I was a reporter at the Boston Globe, then the Washington Post, and now I'm a senior national correspondent at Time magazine. And this is my second book. My first book was about Florida and the Everglades. It's called The Swamp. While I was down in South Beach working on it, I met my now wife and tried dragging her back to D.C., but it didn't take. So I now live in the public policy paradise of South Beach, and yet I'm sitting here writing Washington books.
That's interesting. I mean, does that give you, you think that you're a little bit outside the beltway? Does that give you a better perspective?
Well, you know, for this book, I really think it did. It's a revisionist history of the stimulus. Essentially, just about everything that you think you know about the stimulus is wrong. And I don't think I could have written it if I still lived in Washington, because the groupthink is just too intense. They're just, you know, the herd mentality notion that the Obama stimulus was just this $800 billion joke. It wasn't just conventional wisdom. It was suggesting anything else, like trying to take the stimulus seriously. It was like an admission that you didn't get it. That you kind of weren't in on the narrative. I stumbled into it because I write a lot about energy and the environment. And I knew that the U.S. government had been spending a few billion dollars a year on clean energy, and that the stimulus was pouring in $90 billion, which was leveraging another $100 billion in private capital when really renewable energy had been just about dead in the water. So that just seemed like a really big deal. And as I started looking into this thing, it was clear that there was just this gigantic story hidden in plain sight.
Yeah, what I like about, you know, your book, I mean, you really are swimming against conventional wisdom. You know, everybody, I mean, you hear this everywhere, Washington's broken, Washington is broken. And, I mean, your book, The New Deal, I mean, you're saying, you know, no. I mean, Obama did in the stimulus package something huge and groundbreaking. And you're making a it kind of sounds like you're saying Obama's establishing the groundwork for a new governing paradigm, kind of like the New Deal?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, I think Washington is horribly broken.
Yeah.
And I do think that, you know, that I think my book is, in addition to, you know, obviously probably every author thinks that their story is a great story. I think it is. It's kind of a fun narrative. And then I think the stimulus itself is a really big deal. But I also think it's the best way to understand kind of the president, his policies, his approach to politics, and, you know, his enemies, certainly. You know, there's a lot of inside stuff about the Republicans, but also the insane city in which he's had to operate.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you know, it is a story about change in the Obama era. And, you know, one of Obama's, when he campaigned, his big idea was sort of that you can't have, you know, fundamental change in the country until we kind of have fundamental change in the Capitol.
Yeah.
And he proved that was wrong. you know, it turned out that, I hear him still talking about how change only comes from the outside. That's not true. He proved it. This is a book about, within his first month, before most of his aides knew where the bathrooms were in the West Wing,
mm-hmm.
How he had helped prevent a depression and made this gigantic down payment on his campaign promises for energy and healthcare and education and the largest infrastructure investment since Eisenhower and the largest middle class tax cut since Reagan and the largest one-time research investments ever. And as you mentioned, some real changes to the way the government spends our money, through not only the most transparent and accountable public spending ever, where you can just go online and see what's happening in your neighborhood and see mm-hmm. where every dollar is going, but a real just tremendous effort to crack down on fraud and waste. The bottom line is that when this thing passed, the experts said that 5-7% of it would be lost to fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And I interview Earl Devaney, who's this really hard-nosed investigator who was put in charge of watchdogging this thing. And so far it's been 0.01% lost to fraud. And
really?
Devaney says he's just been flabbergasted.
Wow.
Says, you know, whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, a communist, it doesn't matter. You've got to be just amazed by how clean this thing was. And so I do think there are some new paradigms in the way, I write a lot about how instead of just, you know, the old way of handing out, for example, transportation dollars, anybody who's done their traffic studies and has done their minority hiring studies and wants to build a road, they just sort of raise their hand and check the boxes and they get their money. There's
yeah.
this kind of entitlement mentality, and it's just spread all around the country like peanut butter. What the stimulus really started are these competitive programs to an extent that you've never seen in Washington, where they're asking these shocking questions, really revolutionary. Does your project make any sense? What are the environmental and economic benefits, and can you compete against other projects? And it's a bold thing for Washington because it requires bureaucrats to actually make subjective decisions rather than just shovel paper. And it leads, you know, sometimes things go wrong and then you get, you know, bad headlines when there's this kind of zero defect mentality in government. But it certainly
yeah.
is, there's a lot of good government reform that was sort of embedded in the stimulus, even though most Americans just think of it as a huge boondoggle.
Yeah, I guess the dog that doesn't bark doesn't get a whole lot of headlines. You know, if you're,
That's
you can't
right.
really cover,
That's
oh,
right.
there is no
the planes that go, the planes that land safely, you know,
yeah.
you don't write about those.
So tell me, this is the stimulus package is really, you tell it seems in two parts. First, how did it stop the economic freefall? That seems like it's stopping the economic freefall, and then the second parts are investment and education and energy.
Sure.
So why don't you explain a little bit about, take us back to the, you know, fall of 2008 and the winter of 2009?
Absolutely. I mean, people, people forget because, you know, the financial earthquake had hit in the fall of 2008. But even when Obama took office, the economic tsunami was just starting to reach the shore. So at the time, actually, the official GDP numbers for the fourth quarter of 2008 were negative 4%, which are horrible. But it actually, they later revised it. It turned out it was more like negative 9%, which is a depression, essentially. You know, this was, we were in absolute free fall. As people now know, when Obama took office, we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. And it was really at the time quite uncontroversial, this notion of a stimulus. Every Republican and Democratic presidential candidate had supported what's known as Keynesian stimulus. Mm-hmm. Mitt Romney actually had the largest plan at the time. And in fact, House Republicans voted for a $715 billion stimulus. That was not all that different from the $787 billion Obama stimulus that they ran around trashing as the death of American free enterprise and Sharia socialism and all the rest. At the time, it was really quite, and it's still in the economics profession, it's widely understood that when the private sector just shuts down the way it had at the end of 2008, that the public sector essentially needs to pick up the slack. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, you get this death spiral where businesses are laying off their employees, so they're not spending any money, so more businesses are laying off their employees, and so on and so forth. And that's really the nightmare that Obama inherited when he took office. The stimulus passed in February, and the next quarter actually had the biggest improvement in jobs numbers in 30 years. But of course, because it improved from absolutely terrifyingly hideous to just bad, you know, it wasn't like people were jumping up and down and celebrating, and we were still losing jobs, and that was pretty bad optics after passing a jobs bill to still be losing jobs. But again, financial crises are really, they leave a real nasty recovery behind them, and this was, you know, while helpful, you know, and you could see there have been all kinds of empirical and macroeconomic studies that have found that the stimulus added about 2 to 4% to GDP, which is really the difference between contraction and growth.
Yeah.
That it added about 2.5 to 3 million jobs, which didn't fill an 8 million job hole, but is still pretty good. And on the specifics, particularly at the beginning, you asked about, you know, the short-term recovery stuff was things like giving almost $200 billion to states, mm-hmm. who at the time were just laying off teachers and police officers and firefighters and other public employees in droves and were slashing their Medicaid benefits for the poor and disabled. This allowed them to balance their budget so that they didn't have to raise taxes and cut services and slash their payrolls, which would have continued the debt spiral.
Yeah.
There were also these tax cuts that went to more than 95% of Americans, even though less than 10% of Americans noticed it. And that helped get money into people's wallets that they could then spend and circulate around the economy. And you also had aid to victims of the Great Recession, unemployment benefits and food stamps. And just those direct transfers helped keep more than 7 million Americans from falling below the poverty line. And it helped make more than 32 million Americans who were poor less poor. This is the stuff that really started turning things around right away. And allowed us to have this recovery, this kind of lame, unsatisfying, tepid recovery that we've been kind of stuck in for a few years. But it's way better than the absolute nightmare scenario that we were free falling towards.
Yeah, it seems that, you know, when the recession I remember most, I think we're about the same age, is the early 1980s, you know, unemployment reached about 10%. And if memory serves, I mean, employment levels didn't really fully recover until the mid-90s. I mean, where you get 5% unemployment. I mean, unemployment stayed uncomfortably high throughout the Reagan years. And then we had the George Bush double-dip recession. I mean, it takes a good decade or so, doesn't it, to kind of
What happened in 2008 was made what happened in 1981 look like child's play. Because really, I mean, when you look at the number, I mean, the shock of 2008 was, if you measure it, was worse than the shock of 1929.
Hmm.
Now, of course, what happened in 1929 was they didn't really do anything about it for 3 years, and they allowed that death spiral to keep going, and that's how you end up with 25% unemployment.
Yeah.
But as I quote Larry Summers, who was running around in 2008, in December 2008, predicting some of this stuff, he said, you know, FDR was lucky. He had 3 years of depression before he took over, so everybody knew it was Hoover's depression. Obama was kind of catching the falling spear, you know, and it's to his credit that he helped prevent that sort of awfulness. But politically, it's been sort of awkward because that tidal wave continued to wash over the country throughout the rest of 2009.
Yeah. Well, okay. So you have the stimulus package. Part of it is it disrupts the economic free for all, the death spiral, as you call it. So, but you're also saying that Obama is establishing a new agenda. Okay. So could you walk us through the stimulus and the new agenda?
Yeah. I mean, the stimulus is really, it's the purest distillation of what Obama meant by change.
Mm-hmm.
He had talked a lot during the campaign, and people didn't really pay that much attention to his agenda because they were interested in his race and his crazy pastor, right? And the ads comparing him to Paris Hilton. And then also he was, you know, all that kind of fancy, nice talk about changing Washington and setting aside childish things. And we all know that hasn't happened.
Yeah.
But he did lay out this very specific agenda, which, in fairness, was not a really new agenda. These were pretty familiar ideas. They were kind of standard Democratic ideas, and a lot of them were bipartisan ideas. But they involved, you know, a transition away from fossil fuels, and our dependence on foreign oil, reducing health care costs, reforming education, and then the kind of economy writ large, making it more competitive, and a fairer, sort of more future-oriented 21st century economy.
Mm-hmm.
And he went ahead and, you know, it's sort of, well, you're spending $800 billion. Hey, why don't you spend some of it on the things that you said you were going to do? You know, he saw the famous Rahm Emanuel line about how, you know, it would be such a shame to waste a crisis.
Yeah.
And they didn't. I mentioned clean energy. I mean, it's just mind-boggling, the investments. Just unprecedented cash for wind, solar, and other renewables, for energy efficiency in just about every form, which is really the kind of killer app of the energy world, for advanced biofuels, the smart grid, cleaner coal, electric vehicles, the factories to make all this green stuff in the United States, this new awesome clean energy research agency called ARPA-E that's modeled on DARPA, you know, the Pentagon agency that invented the internet and, you know, the M16 rifle and GPS technology. Well, these guys are sort of inventing the clean energy technologies of the future. It's like the kind of place that Q from the James Bond movies would want to work. So it's just entirely transformative. And you're seeing, you know, it's the reason that we've doubled wind power and increased solar power more than 600%. You've created an entirely new battery industry for electric vehicles, just about from scratch, more than 30 factories when before we had one. The smart grid really has taken off in ways that you don't notice it when a tree branch falls and takes down a wire in Cleveland, and this time it doesn't black out 8 states like the way it did a few years ago.
Yeah.
But you know, these are real changes in the way we use and generate our energy. At the same time, you know, $27 billion for health information technology, right? We've got online dating. We've got online banking. Why do we still have to fill out 30 pieces of paper every time we go to the doctor's office?
Yeah.
Like, why do two doctors have to be in the same room to look at the same file? You know, why can the nurse kill you with her chicken scratch handwriting, you know, if the prescription gets filled out wrong? These are all problems that have plagued medicine for as long as we've had it, and are going to be fixed by like 2016, 2017 because of the stimulus. We've already tripled our adoption of electronic records. And you've got in education, you've got Race to the Top, which is the biggest most ambitious reform in probably 30, 40 years. You've got high speed rail, which is just getting off the ground. You've got an expansion of broadband, which is, really, it's like the modern equivalent of rural electrification, right? Bringing high speed internet to underserved areas. You've got new ways of doing, you're expanding the unemployment system, which really hasn't been fixed since it was starting during the New Deal. There's homelessness prevention. There's this little program called Build America Bonds that nobody even noticed that's financing $180 billion worth of local infrastructure projects. It's like a stimulus tucked inside the stimulus. So there's just all this, this is kind of the Obama agenda, right? Change we can believe in. And everybody, now 4 years later, people are like, well, whatever happened to change? Actually, he did quite a lot of it in his first month.
That's, I think of
Sorry
somebody.
To ramble.
No, not at all. I think of somebody
who
follows politics. I mean, I write about it, I study it, and then I'm, and that's the great thing about reading your book. You're just like, oh, I remember that stimulus bill, and then you're reading it, and you're like, oh, wow, that's a heck of a lot more. I don't know what the word is, groundbreaking than I ever imagined it would be. Now.
Well, it's partly because of the narrative at the time, right?
Yeah.
Because you had you had Republicans who did this magnificent job of just making it sound like $800 billion worth of turtle tunnels and mob museums. And then the Democrats were mostly whining about how it wasn't big enough or too many tax cuts. And the media, which has really kind of blown the story as badly as they blew the run up to the war in Iraq. they're not interested in public policy. They hear kind of like he said, she said, and he says it's a mess, and she kind of says it's a mess too. Then Obama was having trouble getting his message together, and before he, before he really could figure things out in terms of the message, then he was on to the next hideously unpopular auto bailout, and then the hideously unpopular healthcare reform. While the Republican message of big government, big spending, big mess never really they never changed that. And it just seemed to stick. And, a year later, the percentage of Americans who believed that the stimulus created any jobs was lower than the percentage of Americans who believed Elvis was alive.
Now, one thing I did like about your book is you kind of have a sophisticated, I think I'd say, kind of view of Obama, and he comes off, especially when people think about Bill Clinton. I remember at the convention, and all of a sudden reporters were waxing about what happened to that centrist Democrat. Seemed like they were always complaining about the fact that they didn't think Clinton believed in anything when he was in the White House, but then he's gone, and then that was the narrative. But you very much make Obama into, it seems to me at least, a centrist liberal. Do you agree with that?
He's progressive. He's certainly not a sort of New Deal paleo liberal. He's certainly market oriented. And this, I always point out, I didn't call my book Another New Deal. It's a new New Deal. It's different. It didn't create these giant armies of government workers at alphabet agencies like the CCC and WPA. Didn't create like Social Security and deposit insurance and these other entitlements. It didn't really create big government, right? Because we already got big government. FDR created that. This is really about trying to make government work better. And sort of Obama is he's just kind of left of center, but pragmatic technocrat who doesn't really sacrifice the good to try to pursue the perfect. And really has really kind of taken the world as it is, and not how and improved it within his power rather than kind of tilting it windmills. I mean, he campaigned as this kind of change the system outsider, but he really has governed as a work the system insider. because bills that don't get 60 votes in the U.S. Senate don't make change. And so I think there's this, you know, there's this notion like, oh, you know, Obama, you know, he promised to do, you know, the stimulus should have been bigger. Well, he didn't. You know, he didn't have the votes for that because there were three Republicans and more than half a dozen Democrats in the Senate who said absolutely not one dime more than $800 billion. So $800 billion it was. That was pretty good considering that a $50 billion stimulus bill had failed in the Senate in just a few months earlier. So I think, you know, you saw one thing I always say is that if you paid really close attention to the stimulus debate, nothing that happened in the rest of the Obama presidency should surprise you, because he really did. He focused on it. He played an inside game. He got the votes, and you saw the same thing happen in healthcare, where he had no votes to spare. He didn't, you know, there was no public option that liberals wanted, but he didn't have enough votes for. He had to make some kind of unsavory deals, the Cornhusker kickback and Louisiana Purchase and, you know, other kind of things to buy off wavering senators, that you certainly see stuff like that in the stimulus too. But ultimately he did a very big, very unpopular, but very transformative achievement, in healthcare. And what I tried to show in my book, even though nobody noticed at the time, was that the stimulus is just as transformative.
Yeah. So this is what I'm kind of most interested in, and this is, you know, what, you know, it is in your book, but you can't really spell it out. I want to know about your sources. Who was most surprising to you? Maybe you can't name names, but if you can, that'd be great. I mean, who were surprising?
No, I can name names. Yeah. And one of the great things about the book is that just about everybody's on the record.
Yeah.
I've said that I spoke to just about everybody in the Obama administration who had anything to do with the stimulus, except for Obama himself, mm-hmm. who did not cooperate. But I spent a lot of time with Joe Biden, who is a trip. And he and Rahm Emanuel are definitely, they're the kind of, aside from being very important players in the story, they provide a lot of comic relief in the book. There's a great scene at the end where Biden's kind of giving me a hard time, and he's like kind of suggesting that I'm in this big stimulus shill. And he's saying, I took your articles to bed with me. I slept with them. And obviously, you know, I didn't get into journalism to write the kind of articles that Joe Biden would want to cuddle with. but he did, you know, he is correct that I did. As he says, like, I was the only one writing anything nice about it. But you know, he let me sit in on his cabinet meetings that he led, I think 22 cabinet meetings just devoted to the stimulus, which was more than Obama led on all topics. And it was really fascinating to watch him work. And in some ways, I think he oversaw the stimulus, and he was kind of born to do that. While Rahm, you know, Obama was sending a signal about how he planned to govern the day he hired Rahm.
Yeah.
Right. You know, Rahm is an insider. You know, and you knew if Rahm was doing this, it was going to be a little ugly. It was going to be loud. It wasn't going to be suitable for young ears. There are hilarious stories where he's cutting the deals to get this thing done, and he's screaming his head off, and he's calling the blue dog Democrats mother bleepers, and he's calling David Obie, the House Appropriations Chairman. He's saying, you know, this isn't your bill, you bleep. This is the president's bill, during a fight over Race to the Top. And he has this complete explosion with Arlen Specter, when Arlen Specter is insisting, A, that the Recovery Act cannot be bigger than $800 billion, but B, that there has to be $10 billion for the National Institute of Health. And Rahm just loses it, and he's going, how the bleep am I supposed to keep this bleeping thing under $800 bleeping billion dollars if I have to give every bleeping senator 10?
All the stories are true then.
Yeah, no, it's all, and it was, I'd love to sort of brag about, you know, what a brilliant investigative reporter I am.
Yeah.
But the fact is that this was really, you know, a lot of this was really hidden in plain view, and I'm very pleased that particularly Republicans, opened up about their kind of plot to destroy Obama before he even took office.
Yeah.
That, I think, was maybe stuff that really, you know, that was took a little bit more digging. But this notion that the, you know, the stimulus was vast and transformative, and the way it became, you know, came into law so unbelievably quickly during this economic emergency, you know, that wasn't that hard. You know, it was, you know, I talked to everybody who was involved, and it wasn't, aside from Obama, it wasn't hard getting them to talk. The Republicans talking about their little conspiracies was a little harder. At the time, they were kind of proud of it at the time because, you know, say what you will, it took some guts for them at a time when the president was at 70% in the polls and everybody was, you know, there were just been a few million people on the mall saying, yes, we can. And everybody was saying that the Republicans were doomed if they didn't cooperate with them during an economic emergency. It took some guts for them to say, like, no, our path back to power is to say no.
You use the term, you call them an entrepreneurial minority. Why don't you talk just a little bit about you know, the Republican strategy and what you know the scoop that you got on the Republican decision how they're going to deal with Obama?
Sure. Well, I do. There are a couple of meetings that I write about with you know, for example, you know, in December 2008, you know, with Yes We Can still ringing in everybody's ears, I write about a meeting that Eric Cantor has with his whip team where basically he says, we're going to fight this guy. We're not going to roll over. You know, where our base doesn't want us to, and there's no point in just going along with them. Mitch McConnell had a very similar meeting with his entire caucus. They were incredibly demoralized. And he basically said, you know, this is our moment. We have to stick together. We have to fight. He tells the story about 1984, which everybody remembers as the morning in America Reagan landslide. But what McConnell remembered is that all the Democrats got reelected that year too, because he was the only Republican challenger to beat an incumbent Democratic senator. And so his lesson was, hey, if we stick together and say no, and it turns out that Obama's a genius, and even though all the economists say this thing's going to take years, he turns it around right away, so everybody's fat and happy. We're going to get reelected, because people get reelected when everybody's fat and happy.
Yeah.
But if this economy doesn't turn right around, that's our path back to power. And they understood that. McConnell also understood that, you know, and Cantor too, that their most important task was to keep stuff partisan. Because to deny Obama partisan victories, because, you know, most of us, we don't, you know, I'm paid to pay attention to this stuff, but most people, like, all they know about stuff that goes on in Washington, it's like either they've figured it out, they've got something bipartisan, reasonable, or they've agreed, or else it's just the same old partisan bickering. And so they recognized from the beginning that they had to keep it the same old partisan bickering. After the vote on the stimulus, where Obama had just gotten this huge victory for his agenda, and really was starting to transform the country in the way he had laid out that he was going to do it during the campaign, incredible substantive defeat for the Republicans, they had this retreat in Virginia, which was like a raucous celebration because they had all stuck together and voted no. And John Boehner played a tape of the from C-SPAN of the vote and got a standing ovation. And Cantor got up and said, you know, we're going to have more votes just like this one. And Mike Pence actually played a clip from the movie Patton where he's screaming, we're going to run through the enemy like crap through a goose. And of course, Patton was talking about the Nazis and Pence was talking about Obama and the Democrats. But what they understood was that by sticking together, and, you know, even though everybody had been for stimulus just a few weeks before, and even though Obamacare is really not that different from Romneycare, and even though Obama's cap and trade plan was the same cap and trade plan that John McCain and Sarah Palin had pushed in 2008, by standing together on the other side of that, they could really change the political dynamics in a hurry, at a time when jobs were disappearing and people were unhappy.
Well, yeah, I mean, and they captured at least the speakership the next year.
That's right.
So let me ask you this. If you look at the current polls, I mean, it seems that Obama is doing quite well. Romney is, right. His campaign is listing. Do you think the stimulus has anything to do with this? Do you think Americans are kind of implicitly sort of kind of realize that the stimulus made things from getting worse? I mean, is there a connection or not?
Well, I would say a couple of things. I mean, the first thing is that politically, certainly, although, you know, now Obama has started bragging about the auto bailout, which was once incredibly toxic.
Yeah.
But now, you know, you hear the famous GM is alive and Osama bin Laden is dead.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And he's even started to say, you know, talk about Obamacare, right? He says mm-hmm. Obamacare. That's right. You know, he's starting to embrace that term, which used to be just a pure epithet. He still won't say the S word. You'll never hear him talk about the stimulus.
Yeah.
But he is talking about some of the things the stimulus did, right? You'll hear him talk about Race to the Top or the fact that he cut taxes for 95% of the country, the fact that renewable energy has doubled in this country, which is entirely because of the stimulus, on the day after the stimulus passed, the Spanish wind company called Abengoa, which had shut down all its U.S. projects, announced that it was investing $6 billion in the U.S. wind projects. I mean, it was really, it was night and day. So he isn't saying like, hey, the stimulus did that, but he is talking about its achievements. The larger effect, I think, that the stimulus had was the concept of stimulus, because Obama not only got the $800 billion in stimulus, he then followed it up with another about $700 billion in 2009 and 2010. That didn't get a lot of attention because he wasn't running around the country saying, I want another stimulus. Instead, he was doing it sort of quietly. There was a bill to save teachers' jobs and bill to extend unemployment benefits and even bills to cut small business taxes that Republicans opposed en masse, even though these were classic Republican ideas. So he did get an awful lot of stimulus. And that kept the unemployment rate from skyrocketing the way you saw in some places abroad.
Yeah.
And then after Republicans took over and started pushing austerity, he pushed the American Jobs Act instead, which was another essentially a second stimulus, though he didn't call it that. Now, it didn't pass, but the Republicans' austerity didn't pass either. So instead of places like Great Britain and Spain, which did enact austerity regimes that led to double-dip recessions, the U.S. has just kind of kept puttering along on their unacceptable but not, you know, disastrous path.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you're seeing, I don't know, you've seen the last few days some economic indicators are pointing maybe to some good signs.
Right.
Before
but
we
certainly
have our...
the idea, certainly you hear like when the Republicans say, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, right? That's an influence that reminds people where they were 4 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how bad things were, which is a sort of implicit in the fact that people are realizing, hey, you know, I actually am better off than I was 4 years ago, because 4 years ago the economy had just fallen off a cliff. That's a sort of implicit endorsement or at least acknowledgement of what the stimulus has achieved. Probably Romney would be better off, instead of asking, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, just sort of, how you doing? Right.
Yeah. Well, maybe the Romney people will listen to this and take your advice. That's actually not a bad idea. Before we have our typical, this is always our last question. I just want to this is, you know, the new deal. I mean, I really do. I think this is sort of, I don't know if the term is long form journalism, but I mean, it's a gripping read. I mean, I don't know. I couldn't put it down. And,
thanks.
Yeah. And I would urge our listeners to go out and pick up a copy. But our typical, our last question is, what are you working on next? Do you have another, are you just doing sort of day to day journalism, or you have another book, or?
I'm reintroducing myself to my family.
Understood.
And you know, I'm covering the campaign. Mm-hmm. And it's been fun because, you know, I've gotten to essentially write about all the issues in the book all over again, because although, you know, part of the Romney campaign really has made this about stimulus. So I've, you know, it's been practically a full-time job fact-checking every time they tell these doozies about how, you know, the stimulus is outsourcing wind turbines to China, when in fact it's been insourcing wind turbines, or how, you know, Solyndra was a, you know, crony capitalist deal, mm-hmm. when in fact it was first approved by the Bush administration. And don't get me started about all the different ways it's not a scandal. But so I've been able to write a lot about that. And then even on the Obama side, this has become somewhat, you know, this election is sort of about the future role of government. Mm-hmm. And Romney has made the stimulus into kind of exhibit A for the idea that government doesn't work. And I think what my book does, although it doesn't, I don't make any sort of big claims about how big government is good or, you know, big government always works, but really the stimulus is exhibit A for the idea that government can work and that it can produce positive change. And ultimately, this is a book about change.
Hmm. Well, it's the New Deal. Mike Grunwald, thank you for, you know, giving us some of your time in between what promoting your book and covering the campaign. I guess you're going to have a pretty busy next, 40 days till the election?
I think it's, 38 and counting?
38.
Right?
Is there early voting in Florida?
Yeah, it hasn't started yet. But,
okay, so yeah, the election's already begun in certain places. Well, thanks, right. Mike. And
it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate your interest and your kind words.
Okay, well, thanks. Have a good day.
You too. Take care.
Okay, bye. I hope you enjoyed our interview with Michael Grunwald, and maybe piqued your interest in picking up a copy of his book, The New Deal. Please, add us to your list of favorites, New Books in Politics. We're going to try to have a podcast or an interview with an author about once a week. So I look forward to having you on the other end of this conversation quite soon. Bye.